Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill, employee-owned and operated, and founded on the principle of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Good evening and welcome to For Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org, archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. My name is Chris Kuzmi. I'm a co-host through this weekly journey of all things fermented. My co-hosts Mary and Rachel are unavailable tonight, but I had the pleasure of going up to the Culinary Institute of America and interviewing the people behind the brewing program up there. They have a curriculum basically teaching people in a live working brewery how to brew, the science behind it, and the actions within it. There will be an episode coming up. I also was able to sit in on the food sciences fermentation class with Professor J.J. Liu, who was so awesome, and it was such an amazing class. It was like it was like everything that For Men About It is about. We went through kimchi, soy sauce, cheese making, bread making. It was pretty incredible. I can't wait to talk to him in episodes to come. Before we get right into this interview, I want to shout out that you can expect to hear something on The Speakeasy by Souther Teague, The Farm Report, Aaron Fairbanks, and also Sam Ben Ruby, The Grape Nation, and Feast Your Ears with Harry Rosenblum. We all went up there together for a field trip to the CIA, so some episodes coming up soon will feature the CIA. Thank you, CIA, for your hospitality, particularly Jeff Levine and Ginny Muir for coordinating it. Thank you, and enjoy episode 211 of For Men About It.
Good evening, welcome to For Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm here at the Culinary Institute of the Americas.
Culinary Institute of America.
Of America.
The CIA.
The good one. But you guys have facilities, actually. You guys are in partnerships with a couple things across the world. There's a Singapore thing.
San Antonio. And Napa Valley.
I just had the pleasure of joining the fermentation class, which is the culinary science, part of the culinary sciences degree. But I'm here in the brewery with John Fisher, the brewfessor. Is that what they call you?
Yep. Well, I call myself.
What you call yourself. Well, at least
self-appointed title.
Self-appointed title. And Professor Hutch Kupin.
Cheers,
and thank you for joining us.
Sure.
Thanks for letting me join you.
Yeah, we're happy to have you.
Hutch, I've followed your career for a very long time. I love your work. You make delicious beers.
Thank you.
How did this gig come up for you?
I've been in the Hudson Valley for 7 years now. I've been in New York City for 15, actually this past 15 years brewing. I really enjoyed the Hudson Valley. I lived in the Adirondacks for a long time. Love that. Except for the fact that winter lasts for like 10 months of the year. I just really settled in the Hudson Valley when I was at Crossroads for, you know, opening up the brew pub up there. And so I kind of want to stay in the area. And so the chance to be able to stay here and work with Brooklyn Brewery and the Culinary Institute of America, like two highly respected companies, or organizations is probably a better word, was pretty hard to pass up. I actually was a teacher before I was a brewer, so I have always enjoyed teaching and training people. So a chance to be able to work with John and work with the students, and you know, I do spend a pretty good portion of my time working directly with the students and getting to teach them about, you know, brewing. We really focus more on brewing than we focus on beer, although we do cover some beer, you know, plenty of beer stuff in our class.
What does that mean?
It means rather than the class being about beer styles and beer appreciation, gotcha, beer history, it's, you know, we do talk about beer flavors when we're talking about souring and sour techniques and how, you know, a Brett beer is different than a kettle sour, you know, or when we talk about hops and, you know, John will do a tasting with them of both fresh and old versions of the same hopped beer, things like that. So we do talk about beer, but it's more from the process flavor side than it is about beer appreciation and like how you go about tasting.
We don't have a ton of tastings, which right, the other class, the other beer class does. It is more about the different styles and exploring the styles. This class, the art and science of brewing, is about the art and science of brewing.
Mm-hmm. There are students of all ages here. How's that navigated when it comes to tasting?
Oh, we actually have a dispensation from the state that allows underage students to, the actual phrase is consume and dispose.
Gotcha.
So we have spit cups out, mm-hmm, and our students are allowed to taste when they're 18 and 17 years old, but they have to spit. When I teach the spirits class, I use clear spit cups, which, as gross as it may sound, it lets the students know that I can see if they're spitting or not.
Right. So, John, how did you come to this position, and how long have you been here at CIA?
Well, I graduated from here in 1988, and I came here to learn how to cook so I could be a better front-of-the-house manager, which was very rare in 1986. Everybody else wanted to be a cook, but I knew that if I wanted to be a mechanic, I needed to know how the engine worked. So if I was going to be a restaurant manager, I needed to know the kitchen as well as anybody. So I ended up then working in Manhattan at a number of great restaurants. So I was always the wine and beverage manager. I was a cellar manager at the Rainbow Room, beverage manager at Tom Colicchio's first restaurant, Mondrian. But the whole time I was in the city, I knew I was going to come back to teach at my alma mater at some point. And that happened in 2000. And I started in the restaurants as a maitre d' instructor. And then two of my cohorts and I started developing beverage management classes. And we created the wine and beverage management specialization that we have now for about 5 years, where they spend one semester at our Greystone campus in the Napa Valley, where they have a little bit of wine and learn about it there. And they spend the rest of the time with us here. And there's a beverage management class that's just management. There's spirits and mixology, the two beer classes, advanced wine, and basically get them ready for a career that they hadn't thought about before they came to the school, and they thought they were going to be chefs, and mm-hmm, we changed their minds.
How intensive is the? Is there a degree specifically for brewing here at Fort Spirits?
No, it's not. So the beer class, because it's fairly new, they only opened up the building here, the Egg, about in June 2015, and then the brewery went live in October of 15. Mm-hmm. So the beverage specialization was already well established by that point. Right. So it's our class is not a requirement for that, although I will say a very large number of the students who are beverage specialists want to take the brewing class because they want to fill in that part of their education.
Sure.
So, but our class is open to any bachelor student. So it's not necessarily, it's not a requirement.
It's not technically part of the specialization.
But it fits well into what their interest level is.
Exactly.
Sure. So you're primarily teaching here in and on site at the brewery.
Correct.
Talk a little about the size of the brewery and
sure. It's a 7-barrel brew house, which you know, pretty typical brew pub size. We actually have a 3-vessel brew house with a separate mash kettle and water tun, which is unusual at this size. You wouldn't really need it, but it's a good teaching tool to separate the different parts of the process. 3 fermentation tanks, 1 bright beer tank. Everything served into kegs. So all of our restaurants, we have beer on tap here at the brewery, in the Student Commons, and then all of our restaurants have beer on tap as well. They all had to be retrofit. They didn't have draft beer before we opened the brewery. So Everything's under bar coolers, and so we're all in six-stall kegs. It's a JB Northwest system, so U.S. built. Really nicely high-end showpiece system, the brewery, as you can see, all glassed in.
Yeah.
With nice sound-resistant glass, which I'm very, very fond of, so nobody can hear me when I scream.
And blast proof.
That's right. Oh, when the tunes turn up, they can't really hear the tunes. You know, you can't have a quiet brewery. It's a great brewery. It really is. It's very efficient, and everything is new. Mm-hmm. You know, which is
shiny.
Wonderful. And we have. I'm very thankful that the Culinary Institute has a great facility staff and engineers and things like that, and boiler techs and people like that who are a phone call away when we have problems, which is a nice luxury to have. And as you've noticed, we have AC, which is also a pretty luxurious thing.
As a brewer. As a brewer, that's very
somebody
special.
Somebody that fixes your stuff, gives you AC, and cleans your brewery is kind of like, that just doesn't happen.
And floors that don't puddle, the pool.
Yes, yeah, floors are properly sloped, so the drains.
That's happiness, I show you.
And the food ain't bad here.
Yeah, you're right here directly to it. And so for you, Professor John Fisher, what the class, you're in the classroom setting primarily.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I do come and participate in the labs whenever possible. But I teach in the classroom, so I lecture twice a week. Technically, it's an hour and a half class, credit-wise. And I cover science, ingredients. We go extensively into chemistry of beer, all of the ingredients. We cover water, pH, everything. So we
and then process, hot and cold side process. And
hot side, cold side.
Beer faults, you know, tasting beer faults. Sour
packaging.
Beers. We bring in a number of guest speakers as well, usually two or three. Brooklyn is heavily involved in that. They go up and talk about branding and brand identity and like global brand identity.
The marketing people come up every semester.
Garrett's usually really good about coming up and talking to the students about the state of the beer industry and, you know, giving them a cool tasting of unique beers. And then we bring some, you know, one or two other people in that maybe represent a different part of the industry.
Local brewers.
Yeah, so some local brewers. We've had people come talk about building out a brewery. So Jeff O'Neill came and talked about site selection and what goes into building a brewery. Joe Turco came and talked about the distributor brewer relationship, you know, for craft distributors. You know Jeff Wenzel. He's now at New Belgium. Came and talked about the New Belgium's barrel program this semester, which was really cool. He happened to be in town.
You guys aren't doing wood here yet.
No, I mean, you're kind of looking at all the space we have.
Right. So, there's one.
There's one little guy in the corner. one of the drawbacks, I guess, probably is we just don't have a ton of storage space.
Sure.
I would end up having to leave barrels out in the hallway there, and it's probably asking for trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is kind of a shame because we have great relationships with Hill Rock and Putt Hill Town, and they're good friends of the school, and I've known especially the Putt Hill Town guys for a long time. That's my 7-gallon Putt Hill Town barrel right there.
It is. I mean, we actually really would have the time to age some things, which would be nice. Mm-hmm. We'll make it work somehow. There are catacombs underneath the campus, so originally the main building
was a seminary.
Oh wow! Okay.
So there are tunnels that just seem like they really should have beer barrels in them. How we're going to go about doing that, I don't know. Maybe get a team of sled dogs to drag them in there or something. I'm not sure how we go about that.
Right.
But but it's not a dead idea.
Sled dogs?
It's not a dead idea. So we'll figure something out.
So going back to that, you say you would have time to do that because how often are you brewing?
About once a week.
Okay.
So we're putting out three or four batches a month because our beer can legally be only sold here on campus.
Okay.
Which is great. You know, gives us that opportunity to do some different things. But we're not at, say, full capacity or full bore like you would be in, you know, a small business. Also, the school closes for different points of the year. So the school is shut down for 3 weeks in August. For three more weeks after that, none of the bachelor students are here. They get a 6-week break. There's 3 weeks in April when the bachelor students have off. We're closed to 10 days for Christmas. So there, we have a restaurant that opens and closes depending on student enrollment. So it's usually open in the spring when we have more students who need to work in that. This year it was a beer-forward gastropub called Post Road Brewhouse. So that gave me the opportunity to create a whole bunch of new stuff.
Sure.
You know, certain times of the year, there's an ebb and flow to our demand, and as a result, an ebb and flow to my schedule, or to the brewery schedule, I should say.
And you said you had three regular beers that you're...
IPA and a wit.
All year round? Okay.
So Cleaver IPA and Mise en Place wit. Then every class of students gets to create a new beer. So we give them a research project. We give them 5 styles to research. They have to do group presentations where they present to the class about the history of the style and flavor profile. So we're choosing classic styles in that case. Flavor profile and, you know...
Ingredients, recipe.
What ingredients you would use to get that flavor, writing a recipe for it, naming it. And then the class, we taste examples, commercial examples of all those styles, and the class as a whole votes on which one they want to make as their class project. So we've got a Saison in the tank right now. Which rather than just doing like kind of a DuPont clone, we did, we dry hopped it with Galaxy and Citra. So kind of nice hoppy. It's about 11 days old right now. So kind of, you know, still drinkable, still a Belgian Saison, but with that definite hop character to it. So that'd be fun. And then because we have all these great culinary minds and like a pretty amazing storeroom full of stuff that these kitchens order every day. We get to mess around with some cool ingredients. So, you know, if I want to get some peach puree, I can email and it'll be here tomorrow. Or if I want to get smoked peppercorns, they have them. You know, things like that that I can start to play around with a little bit. So we have a little miniature fermenter that I can use to kind of do some experimental aging and different batches, try different yeast strains on the beers, things like that.
And by miniature, you mean 10 gallons?
20.
20.
20 gallons.
It's a little 20.
Deceiving,
huh?
Yeah.
Completely glycol. Single wall. It is single wall?
It's single wall, but it has a glycol loop built into the lid.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that actually came from Brewmation down in Fishkill. So he had that left over from their pilot system, and so I saved a little on the shipping because I drove down and put it in my Jeep and drove it back up. But that's been great. It's, you know, let us do, you know, I did a habanero mango version of our IPA. You know, we're doing right now, I've got our regular wheat beer, but with no spices and with American yeast. So it's basically American wheat beer that I threw some other stuff into. So we can mess around a little bit and create some different stuff.
Why did you decide on an IPA and a wit as the two regular beers for Brooklyn?
That one probably came from Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. There was a definite, I mean, IPA is, you have to have an IPA, right?
Yes.
It's number one. The president of the school, President Ryan, actually really wanted to have a fruit-forward IPA. Mm-hmm. You know, more. I wouldn't say it's quite what's popular now, but 3 years ago it was what was, you know, pretty popular.
Sure.
And he was familiar with some of the beers in New York and had named a few by specifically that he liked. So I kind of, you know, said, all right, well, let's do something different with that. You know, let's not just make a beer that everybody else can get. So it's definitely an approachable IPA, very little bitterness, but has a lot of mosaic hops in it. It shows off the mosaic nicely. And then we wanted to do something different that was a lighter beer, but that was food friendly. We thought, you know, really Garrett thought that wit beer would be a good choice for that, right? Lighter and drinkable. And so the wit beer recipe is actually 95% Garrett's original recipe that he passed on to me. So I've made a few alterations to it with his blessing. But it's pretty traditional Belgian wit. Really nice, drinkable, clean, but works really well with a lot of our different dishes. Because remember, we have these restaurants that we're really selling the beer at, and most of our restaurants are not necessarily drawing in a beer-savvy crowd. You know, people who like flavor, but not necessarily people who are into beer. So we wanted to offer beers that were approachable enough that they would work with the dishes we have. So, you know, the IPA and the whip beer are on at Bocuse, you know, the high-end French restaurant. It's got to be something that works with the food there.
So you might not think of Belgian wit as a year-round beer. You know, it tends towards more seasonal, but if you think about it as applications with food, it's a great fish beer.
Absolutely.
You know, so, and our restaurants, you know, there's an American, an Italian, and a modern French, and the wit works with those cuisines pretty well.
My first food pairing wow moment was a Garrett moment. He was doing a cooking and pairing beer display, and he paired the Brooklyn, I think it was Blanche de Brooklyn, with a goat cheese and Granny Smith apple omelet.
Perfect.
It just blew my mind.
Yeah. That was like, perfect. The tartness of the goat cheese and the crisp whipped beer. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of...
And it's funny, people always laugh at me when I say wit is a great brunch beer. Like, people always give me, I'm like, yeah, it's great with eggs. Like, what are you talking about? Like, everyone laughs, aha, beer with breakfast. I'm like, wit at brunch is the perfect beer.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. I have employees who've been with me for more than 30 years, and plus. Each and every one of them deserves to be an owner. That's just the way it ought to be, and that's just the way it is.
This is Bob Moore. He and his wife, Charlie, started Bob's Red Mill almost four decades ago. Today, they offer one of the largest lines of organic whole grain foods in the country. And in 2010, on his 81st birthday, Bob gifted ownership of the company to his employees.
I'd received plenty of offers to buy my company over the years, but selling out never felt like the right thing to do. When the time comes to let someone else run this show, I can't imagine selling it to a stranger. Giving the company to my hardworking employees just feels right.
The company now has an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP. Stock is put in a retirement plan for all of its employees. When employees retire, the company buys back their shares. According to the National Center for Employee Ownership, about 11,000 companies in the U.S. currently run as ESOPs.
It just shows how much faith and trust Bob has in us.
That's Bo Thomas, the company's engineer and maintenance superintendent. He's been with Bob's Red Mill for over 27 years and has put his four children through college in the process.
For all of us, it's more than just a job. And obviously, it's the same way for Bob, too.
Bob is still very active in the company. He's the president and CEO, and you'll find him working at the mill just about every day. Because when you love something this much, you want to be a part of it.
Well, I may have given them the company, but the boss part is still mine.
Bob's Red Mill is committed to sharing only the freshest, best-tasting whole grain foods on the planet. Learn more about their mission of good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
How long is the class or the curriculum?
One semester, usually a 15-week semester.
15-week semester. And how many kids per or students per
20.
Semester?
20.
Yeah, 20
is the max because of the size of the brewery.
Mm-hmm. And you do a class, your lecture is once a week?
Twice a week, hour and a half.
And then they spend an hour to 3 hours a week in here as lab.
Okay.
And then I usually offer 4 or 5 labs a week so I can get them in a smaller group. So everyone can participate. You know, John was saying that 20 is the max because of the size of the brewery. I've really found that more than about 6 people in here at a time just becomes either boring, you know, worst case scenario is boring, people don't get to participate, but also potentially dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, you got hoses, you got chemicals, you got clamps, you spend a lot of time on safety, even in a brewery that's well designed. People get in each other's way. So there's no benefit to having extra people in here. It's only a hindrance.
Yeah.
So I found that it's easier for me to offer more of my time throughout the week and to make sure that the students get a better experience. And they'll be honest too. When they come in and, you know, it's the 9 a.m. lab this morning, which nobody wants to be walking in here at 8:55, but there's 3 people, it's a much better experience than when it's maxed out.
So that also gives them more bodies to break grain.
That's also true.
But more what?
Bodies to break out the water.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
During the semester, I don't do that. I'm a supervisor.
So they're able to be in doing it at the same time as they're learning it in 3
algorithms. Honestly, it's the only class
in
the culinary.
Chapters, right?
It's the only class in the culinary where they get to do both hands-on and lecture in the same class. We don't tell them that they're getting a lot more credit hours than they're paying for.
Right.
That they're working harder than they have to for the credits.
Class and they spend about 6 hours a week on it.
But they don't care. The fact that they get the lecture and the chance to do it hands-on and to have, you know, if they do hot side before I've done that lecture, they've participated in it, but then when I start lecturing about it, I see light bulbs lighting up.
Yeah.
And similarly, too, if I'm talking about, malt and different things first, if they've already covered that in class, then they already know something. You don't have to describe what crystal malt is. Let's taste it. Let's see how we're going to use it in the beer.
Yeah.
So we try and paste things together as much as possible, but on the other hand, it is an operating brewery, so we might be week one of the semester. If we're brewing and filtering, then I get people in here helping me brew and filter because every one of those is an opportunity for them to participate in the class. So I try not to waste any of those. So a lot of my more interesting hands-on work is based in part around their schedules. Mm-hmm. So if I can see IPA tank, they learn how to do it, but I'll do I do a lot of the cleaning. I do a lot of the back-end stuff so that they can come in and do the brewing and the filtering with me. And that can be more interactive.
And also, they don't need to know about the diastatic power of darker malts when Hutch is telling them how to, get started with the mashing in.
You press this button to turn on the hot water. That's what we're saying.
Right.
That's what a hot liquor tank is.
But then eventually they put it all together, we hope.
Yeah.
And then usually right by the end of the semester, they start to become somewhat competent, and then they leave, and we start over again.
And then you're back to...
It's like endlessly training employees.
If you think about it, it's a little bit easier when we have a semester as opposed to our AOS program, where the students are in the restaurants for 3 weeks, and you have a brand new staff every 3 weeks in the kitchen and the dining room, and they've never been in that room before, and we're open on day one for business.
Yeah.
And they've never cooked there before. They've never waited tables there before. And then they get good, and they leave.
Mm-hmm.
And you have another day one. So it's a little bit easier for us on the semester.
Correct.
That's pretty fun. And this all falls into places dear to your heart. Hutch, weren't you a teacher in your first chapter?
I taught middle school. After college, I joined Teach for America and taught middle school in North Carolina for 2 years. That's when I started homebrewing, actually.
Yeah.
Because seventh graders are a pain in the butt. I needed something to blow up some steam.
The college students are.
And plus, as a teacher in North Carolina, I made $0. So I had to make my own beer. That's how I got into homebrewing. And then I moved out to the Northwest and got into good beer out there more. So first I started homebrewing because I thought it sounded cool to make your own beer.
Right.
And I had an older brother that homebrewed. But then out in Oregon, got into learning what good beer really was. And then got my first job out there, and then moved to Lake Placid. Been in New York ever since.
Going back to how many hours they get versus they're getting credit for, I'm pretty sure that I've worked plenty more hours at a brewery than I was paid for too.
So absolutely, it's life training
and the restaurant business.
Right, exactly. I'm pretty sure that's
nobody
exactly.
Nobody gets paid for 120 hours a week in the restaurant business. So.
Right.
Yeah, I never got paid overtime until I came back to teach here. And I got my first paycheck when I had done some doubles. You gave me too much money.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
What is this overtime you speak of? Yeah.
What do you mean I have to work on 4th of July? Right. School's closed? Get out?
Yeah. Did you homebrew before?
No. Before and it's funny, I was just starting to when the plans for the brewery came through, and I said,
nice.
Screw it.
That's good.
We're going to get a real one to play with.
John will come in and help me brew sometimes, especially during the downtimes when we have less students here. Mm-hmm. He'll come in, put on the boots. He's got a pair of boots over there. So mm-hmm. he'll come in and put on some boots and help me brew some beer.
I haven't had a beer shower yet, though.
There's time.
You said yet.
There's time. So this little guy, this 20-gallon guy, are you basically making or just running off some wort that you've made?
Side-streaming wort from either that day's batch, or I'm taking fermented wort and using it as an aging tank. Because, we don't have a whole pilot system for it. And I don't have a matching bright for it.
Right.
It doesn't hold pressure, so everything has to be keg conditioned or pressure conditioned in the kegs. So that's what I've been working on now.
Despite not being able to sell off campus, we see you at festivals, which is a great promotion for the CIA. You've served some beautiful beers, both at Tap New York and random things. But you also do collaborations with local brewers. Tell us about some of that.
Yeah, I mean, I one of the nice things about being... Somehow I became a veteran of the industry.
You're old, Hutch.
I know. I am doing great just by hanging around for a long time. Someone called me a veteran. Nikki calls me, Nikki from Russian Dutch. She calls me Grandpa.
I'm
10 years older than you.
Yeah.
But as a result, though, I know lots of people.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. We've known each other for I don't remember how long.
We were supposed to.
I know we were going to do the brewer trade, which was a great dream.
It's a really good idea.
We can do that. Let's do it.
I still want to do it.
So he was going to come brew at my place. I was going to brew at his place.
Cool.
Of course, that's when you were brewing in a basement.
It was easy to kind of get on.
Did anybody teach my part of the class?
Sure. Actually,
I'll come down and teach there.
So obviously I have a lot of relationships here, so that's led to doing lots of collaborations, which has been fun. I can offer all of this. These culinary ingredients that other people have a hard time getting that I have easy access to. I did a winter pale ale with Rareform up in Troy, Kevin. We wanted to do a winter beer that was not a Christmas beer. So we did like a lemon juniper pale ale, which came out great. We've done collaborations with the one with Industrial Arts going right now.
That's coming out next week, right?
That should be going into cans and draft tomorrow. So that should be coming out in the city. Soon called a Zesty Enterprise. Which is Saison, French Saison with Meyer lemon zest, pink peppercorns, and rose hips. Brewed kind of a cafe au lait stout with a meat at peak scale on Friday. We do the Too Many Cooks collaboration, which all the Hudson Valley brewers get together.
Right.
Brewed with Chatham with a couple
Indian
batches
Ladder.
Indian Ladder up in
Baltimore.
Yeah.
They have a malt farm too, right?
They do their own malt and hops. And pretty good quality stuff. So they actually, because they have a cidery and they have a brewery license, but only like a pilot brewery, they have a tank on a skid mount.
Mm-hmm.
Which basically, so we make the wort here, pump it outside of their tank, and they drive it back and ferment it at their place.
That's great.
Uses every hose.
Yeah, all the hoses connected.
How far
are
you going to go out of this?
Right there on the fire lane. No, go out the door, and actually have one spare heat for those if you need it.
That's awesome.
But because we're just making wort, that's totally legal.
Yeah.
And We've done collaborations, God, who else? A couple with Community Beer Works in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. So we did like a home and away. So they came here and we brewed a Pilsner. And then I went out to Buffalo and brewed with Ryan and Ethan and the gang out there. We did a like a American IPL. I'm sure I'm forgetting.
With all this, I'm just bringing this to say, you know, Viva New York State, and you are now also on the New York State Brewers Association board.
I am, yeah. I'm really, I feel very lucky to be able to work with some cool people. It's great to be in a room of, you know, some new people, some old people who have been around. I mean, Fred Matz, the president now, Chris Erickson, who's been on the board since the beginning, Dick Kalisky, who's been on the board since the beginning. You know, they were, I remember having conversations with them when I moved here from Oregon, being like, hey, why is there not a New York State Brewers Guild? Oregon Brewers Guild is huge.
Yeah.
And they were working on setting it up then in 2002. Yeah, I feel really lucky to work on that and get more involved in kind of trying to promote and help the other brewers, other New York State brewers. And I think right now I'm the only non-brewery owner on the board. So okay. There's Kevin's on the board. Kevin Mullen's on the board too, but he's the owner and brewer for a rare form. But right. I think I'm the only actual straight brewer, not owner, on the board. So I feel like I can represent, you know, the interests of not just the businesses but the workers as well.
Although Mary's been here before, mm-hmm. It was before she got the app. So today I have, with this visit, I now have one more stamp on my passport,
nice.
On my Brewers Association.
Yeah, if anyone doesn't have the app, they should 100% get it. It's a great tool. Like, I was somewhere, I don't know where I was recently, and I was like, man, there's got to be a brewery around here somewhere. Just hit locate the brewery on my app, and it found like 15 breweries in the area.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Which is, these days, not that hard to find 15 breweries in your area, right? We're everywhere.
Yeah.
Popping up like flies. But yeah, I mean, it's been cool. It's been a privilege.
John, are there topics that you would like to see develop further to getting into beer? Is there a point where you guys want to be talking about beer styles, or you know, do you think it's just pretty much where you
think so?
We do have the other class, and Hutch and I have talked about making some changes to it because that was the first beer class before we had the brewery, and we're. You know, to talk about the beer business and the craft beverage business, there's already a course slated for the new Bachelor of Science program that's coming up in about a year and a half. That is called the Business of Craft. So that's a class that I still have to. I made up the name. I haven't written the class yet.
Yeah.
But the opportunities for students to end up in the beer side of the business, because I graduated from here in '88 and I was a sommelier and worked with wine in Manhattan. And cocktails have gotten big. I have two former students working at Dead Rabbit and students all over the place doing the mixology thing. And beer is the next world that we're going to attempt to take over mm-hmm. as the CIA. And so getting our students out and making... We have one graduate, Eric, who runs the barrel program at Brooklyn.
Yep.
And he was a bachelor's student. So, but he's the only one that I know of right now. But to...
I have a couple friends who are CIA graduates. It's Jarrett Moody.
Right.
You know Adam Schmeichel? Used to be the brewer for Adirondack and Lake George.
Yes, I've met him.
He's at McFate now. He's a grad.
Okay.
But then we also... Luke Dorning, who just graduated... Right. Just took our class and graduated this past semester. Just got a job. He was a culinary science student, just got a job in a brewery in North Carolina. So he's our first person to take the class that I think is in the brewing world. But every semester there's two or three people who are really serious about it and really want to be more involved in brewing. And, you know, have both the passion and the knowledge as well as the enthusiasm or ability to work hard without necessarily getting paid a whole lot. That I think will give them a chance to get started in the industry, you know. They're kind of ready for the fact that they're not going to make a ton of money.
And the fact that they signed up for the restaurant business when they came here in the first place means that they have a certain amount of wherewithal.
Right.
They can translate into that kind of job that would need to be able to live with less money at the beginning and have dedication, you know, the combination of brain and brawn.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't envy the challenge of you starting a business of craft course. I think that is something that has to be so adaptable. It's changing so rapidly. Even if you were to design it now to start a year and a half from now is like one of those things. So accounting for changes and
it's I think it's cool. I mean, I think the long-term vision for the school is, you know, over every few years the school begins to adapt to what's current. You know, whether it was originally adding the bachelor's program in the first place back in the 90s or... You know, adding an entrepreneurship program that allows the students to really develop their own idea and run it as a business. Adding a beverage specialization, you know, expanding to different campuses. they're pretty forward thinking. So I think that if we, I can see that in a few years there will be, you know, a beer, more of a beer 101 class about beer appreciation and history, mm-hmm. so that younger students can just learn about beer. There'll be our brewing class, maybe more than one brewing class. There'll be these classes in more the business side of things. I think that there's, you know, there's definitely, and that's just, you know, related to beer. I think that there's interest in that. There's enough passion behind it from the school and the staff here to make it work. Because as John could tell you, you know, like any big college, things only work when someone is a proponent of it. And we have people here who are proponents of this program and of including beer and really helping to educate our students about craft beer. So I think that's something you're going to see more of as we go down the road.
And I'm actually the chairman of the curriculum committee here. So being in on, to a certain degree, the future of, and I'm on the faculty council also, on the future of what our plans are for the school, we are very well aware of the fact that kids are not graduating to be line cooks anymore. Right. You know, when I came here in 86, I was the weirdo because I didn't want to be a cook when I graduated. Everybody I was in class with came here to learn how to cook so they could be a cook. And now, maybe, I don't know, a quarter at the most of our bachelor's grads are staying in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And that means that beverage is a huge part of the potential careers for the other 75%.
Wow.
And the ones who do decide to stay in the kitchens, I mean, they're going on and doing great things. But they're the ones who see the see their future with food as opposed to the rest of the business.
Yeah.
And but you know, the beverage side is all I've done for my whole career, and it's the perfect hybrid between front of the house and back of the house, because you're not stuck in the back cooking and burning and cutting yourself, and you're not stuck in the front only waiting on people. You're still doing stuff.
Absolutely.
But also doing it with and for the guest.
Yep. Absolutely. We're going to end on that. This is beautiful. I love what you guys are doing here. Keep up the good work and
thanks.
Send me qualified people. I'm hiring at Fifth Hammer very soon.
There you go. Well, hopefully, you think you guys will have beer by October?
Yeah, we'll definitely have beer by October.
Because we do a beer festival here. It's our second year. Yeah, Brew U. So it's sort of a beer food education festival. Mm-hmm. So we do breweries right here in, I'd love to have you guys come pour beer. Breweries right here in the Ag, outside, band, and then we have educational seminars going on during the event. So if you want to go learn about cooking with spent grains, you want to learn about pairing beer and cheese together.
Beer and cheese.
And Sarah comes up and does a talk. She did, last year she did intro to sour beer, so she's going to be intro to farmhouse ales.
Oh, cool.
So we'll have chefs.
Is this open to the public?
Yep, open to public. Saturday of Columbus Day weekend. Saturday of GABF weekend also.
Okay.
So October 7th. I think tickets just went on sale, but we'll have food demos going on. Food, everything's included in the price. So food stations, all prepared by the CIA chefs as well as guest chefs. And then, the seminars, we're still developing a few new seminar ideas, but, you know, it's a nice little three-hour package. You come in, you have some beers, you have some food, you go learn about something, you socialize with brewers. And last year we had about a dozen Hudson Valley brewers, a couple cideries as well. So it really was a great festival last year.
Added value above and beyond a normal beer festival.
It seems that way.
Yeah, but food included was nice. Good food included, which was nice.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't just corn dogs and what's left in the freezer. But
awesome. Well, we'll see you there. Brew U.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Fresh Pickings is a podcast by Heritage Radio Network presented by Bob's Red Mill. Love learning about food? Get more superfood for your brain with the featured podcast miniseries, Fresh Pickings. Go to bobsredmill.com/freshpickings.
Are you one of the millions of Americans who have trouble digesting gluten, or are you looking to shed a few pounds by shifting towards a low-carb diet? Well, we've got just the answer for you. Almond flour. Made with 100% sweet almonds, it's the perfect alternative to traditional white flours. Alternative flours are sweeping the nation and taking the baking industry by storm. Welcome to Fresh Pickings. I'm your host, Kat Johnson, and today we're looking at one small nut's journey through the mill and how almond flour can transform everything you thought you knew about baking. On this episode, I'll talk to our resident almond flour expert, Cynthia Cherish Malloran, host of the new podcast Wedding Cake here on HRN. She'll talk about the nutritional benefits of almond flour and how the grain is processed. Then I'll invite Eli Sussman, host of The Line and co-owner and chef of Semesa, to teach us his recipe for almond cake using Bob's Red Mill's almond flour. So stay tuned. I'm here with Katie Mosman-Wadler, the executive director of Heritage Radio Network. So Katie, it's 4:30 in the afternoon. How are you feeling?
I mean, I'm always hungry, but at 4:30, this is the time when I start to think about cookies and how much I would like to have a cookie right now. I'm thinking about snacks.
Well, we probably shouldn't have cookies for an afternoon snack. What about something healthy like almonds?
Yeah, that sounds okay. Not super exciting. I really want a cookie.
Okay, well, maybe we could compromise. What if we made cookies using almond flour? We can use it in place of the white flour, and almond flour is high in protein, low in carbs, and low in sugar, so it'll be a lot healthier.
That actually sounds so delicious. I think we should do it.
Yeah, we can have our cookies and eat them too.
All right, good deal.
And now let's hear about the origins of almond flour and the benefits of using it from our very own expert, Cynthia Cherish Malloran, a.k.a. DJ Cherish the Love. Cynthia is the host of our new show on HRN, Wedding Cake, and she's also a killer DJ and even an ordained minister. So let's start from the beginning. Where does the magical nut, the almond, come from?
Hey, so the almond is native to an area stretching from the northern Indian subcontinent westwards to Syria, Israel, and Turkey. It was spread by humans in ancient times along the shores of the Mediterranean into northern Africa and southern Europe, and more recently transported to other parts of the world, notably California.
California, like, always gets the best stuff. Mm-hmm. So, Cynthia, I've heard a rumor that almonds aren't actually nuts. Is that true?
That is absolutely right, Kat. The almond seed or fruit is not a true nut, but a drupe. The almond is actually the seed of the fruit that grows on almond trees, a medium-sized tree that bears fragrant pink and white flowers. And like its cousins, peach, cherry, and apricot trees, the almond tree bears fruit with stone-like seeds or pits within. The seed of the almond fruit is what we refer to as the almond nut.
So could you eat the fruit that the almond grows in?
No, you know, you really can't. And when I was a kid, I went to visit an almond orchard, and I remembered picking what I thought was an apple off of the tree, bit into it, pretty awful, threw it out, grabbed another, quote, apple, bit into it, and my cousin said, "That's not an apple, that's an almond." And he broke open the, quote, apple, and there it was. One almond.
So I know that almonds are very healthy. What about the health benefits of almonds?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because there is a plethora of great health benefits in almonds. More than 65% of the fat in almond flour is monounsaturated, which is excellent for maintaining healthy cholesterol levels and good overall heart health, which we all love. Additionally, scientists find that almond consumption can reduce the risk of coronary heart disease by keeping blood vessels healthy. Almonds also help manage post-meal blood glucose levels, the presence of insulin in the blood, and oxidative damage, and they raise antioxidant levels in the blood after a meal.
I had no idea that they did all those things. So maybe they should say an almond a day keeps the doctor away.
Yeah, maybe closer to like a handful of almonds. But yes, they do have incredible benefits.
It sounds like these fruits, have a lot more than meets the eye. Anything else we should know?
Yes, plenty. Almonds are notoriously healthy nuts, providing a good amount of manganese and vitamin E, as well as a healthy serving of monounsaturated fats in each quarter cup serving. Because not only do almonds have a healthy boost of protein, they are also very low in carbohydrates and inherently gluten-free, which I love. So when they're ground into a flour, they add moistness and a rich, nutty taste to baked goods. And I'm going to be making a couple of almond flour gluten-free cakes on my show, Wedding Cake, this season.
That's awesome. Well, thanks so much for all this great info, Cynthia.
You're welcome.
Now let's turn to Eli Sussman, who is going to teach us how to use this awesome ingredient. Eli is the host of The Line here on Heritage Radio Network, and he's the chef and co-owner of Semisa, along with his brother Max.
Hey, Kat. So almond flour is made from almonds that have been blanched to remove the skins and then ground to a fine texture that is great for baking. So replacing 25% of the flour in your baking with almond flour will add wonderful texture and flavor while reducing the total carbohydrates. It can be used in savory applications as well, in place of breadcrumbs and meatballs, or even as a coating for chicken and fish.
Awesome. So how do you use almond flour in your cooking at Semisa?
We've been using almond flour in this really delicious dessert that we make. It's an almond cake. We make it in these small bundt pans, and then once we pop them out, we dust them with powdered sugar. They're really nice, bite-sized, really delicious.
That sounds so good. Thanks for sharing. So I will definitely be by Semisa soon to try that. Thanks to Cynthia for schooling me on almonds and to Eli for sharing his tips on using almond flour. You can find his recipe for Semisa's almond cake at bobsredmill.com/freshpickings. Well, that's just about everything you could want to know about almond flour, and this is the season finale of Fresh Pickings. If you liked what you heard, be sure to check out all of the episodes and learn more about Bob's Red Mill's favorite ingredients, including some delicious recipes and great coupon offers, by going to bobsredmill.com/freshpickings. Bob's Red Mill believes in good food for all. For Heritage Radio Network, I'm Kat Johnson, and thanks for joining us.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.